Okay. It's my distinct pleasure to introduce my wife who's going to present this session. Glenn Cornett is also listed on the program. Jan is going to bring up the issue with Glenn. Let me just mention that as you see there, Janet served on the text committee of the hymn book that we now use many years ago. To hear the stories behind the production of the new, it's not new anymore, the current textbook is quite a fascinating story, and I don't know if she's going to touch on any of those, but it's very interesting to know that there was a great deal of politics involved in producing the hymn book, and arguing among general authorities as to which hymn should be there and who should be taken out and who should be put in and all of those sorts of things. And in fact, at one point, the project was entirely shelved for a number of years until a particular general authority passed away because there was an impasse on those on a particular hymn issue. Janet has also served as an editor for the Ensign. She has served on the church editorial committee, and she also was the first woman to play a major role in the church PR department. She handled the print media during the time of the Utah bombing. And Janet's also a talented musician. She's played the organ since six, something like that. 12. All the time that she was growing up, she played the organ for a number of church congregations, not all LDS. And she was in great demand to come and play for other church services where they did not have an organist. That's one of the things that I love so much about her, is that she brings such wonderful music into our family. And of course, because she worked on the hymn committee, she's got an insight into hymns that have been cut out and dropped, and maybe even some of the stories behind why they were dropped and so on. One other aspect that I would like to plug here before I turn the time over to her is that she introduced me to shape note music. A wonderful tradition of singing sacred music in an old style that was very likely to have been used in places like the Kirtland Temple. It was a tradition of singing music in a format that is apparent in the architectural design of the Kirtland Temple. And that has become a very important part of my life. And if you live in the Bay Area here, you might want to join a shape note group. In fact, at the end of the day today, we're going to have a session in which you'll be able to come and sing some shape note music, and you'll be surprised to discover that some of the hymns in our hymn book today derive from the old shape note tradition. So if you enjoy that, please come and join us this afternoon. So I give you Janet Wickham Rand.
I'm not a podium kind of person. I'm inclined to have you sort of move the chairs and gather around a little bit, but only if you want to. I'm also inclined to leave you sitting where you like to sit, because I really resent it when people tell me where I have to sit. But nonetheless, I hope this will feel more like we're all gathered around in a circle than like I'm up here at a podium. But there's a microphone here, and we have to refer to it. As Richard was explaining, my background is not that I'm a musicologist. I'm actually a psychologist. And my background is that I'm an expert in music history or even in hymnody. My background is that I enjoy it, and it's been a part of my life, as with probably virtually all of you since I was very tiny. And that at odd times in my life, a phrase will go through my mind like sultry glebe. And I'm awestruck that probably I'll be the only person maybe out of an entire airport who would know what a sultry glebe is. And, And so at times, and especially like last night when we had the wonderful presentation by Carolyn Pearson, and we had the opening song before it started, and I realized we had no copies of the hymn. We thought we ought to do a hymn, and that one had kept ringing through my mind as the one that we really ought to do because of the power of the words of Health Pharma Foundation. And I thought, how can we do this? No one has the words. And I thought, oh yeah, they have the words. Because even if they don't come from a Mormon tradition, that hymn crosses so many religious boundaries that people have the words. And the words were there. It just needed a little prompting, and you know, the words came. So I come from a tradition of, for me, the most powerful religious experiences that I have typically are tied to music and not to words, not to spoken words. And the most powerful impacts that have occurred to me where I've communicated somehow or deity has gotten through all my barriers and gotten through to me have been associated with music. And so for me, this is the essence of our worship, of whatever being people are worshiping, however they perceive God, that worshiping through singing is, whatever that sounds like, is the most powerful statement, religious statement that we can make, the most powerful form of worship. And so with that is a background of where I'm coming from. I promise not to launch into psychology talk. But I'd like to talk just a little bit about hymn books. And I like you said, I'm not a musicologist, and I don't presume to know everything about the history of all the hymn books. But I do happen to have a couple of small ones. This is a facsimile edition published by the church that's now the Community of Christ Church, which is a reorganized LDS church, that is a facsimile edition of Emma Smith's hymn book published in 1835. And at least one or two of you have this book handy. This is also one that was used in the early LDS church, published in 1844. This is, of course, a facsimile edition of it. And this has one different feature in that there are actually some notes in this particular hymn book. This you can get through if you communicate with the RLDS Church, Community of Christ Church, Kirtland Temple Visitor Center, that carry these. And in the earliest edition, it was only words. Now, some people look at this and go, but how did they know what notes to sing? Well, just the same way that we knew what to sing with Health Pharma Foundation, they had the tunes up here. And the tunes, they were able to do something that cognitively, sorry, that's a psychology word, but cognitively is difficult for us now because we didn't grow up knowing how to do this. They could take these words and they could sing them to any hymn that would fit it, any tune that would fit it. So they could say, for example, hymn number 38 was done in common meter, which is a fairly standard, typical kind of structure for a tune. And once more my soul, the rising day salutes my waking eyes. They could sing that to anything written in common meter that had the same structure. We won't get into all the structural stuff, but so basically they were just very interchangeable. Now, if you want to have an experience in cognitive dissonance, try singing, for example, the Spirit of God to what we use now as the tune for Now Let Us Rejoice. And you will go, I'm brain damaged. You'll have to have it written out, and then you'll have to do it by rote. But for them, it was very natural because this is how hymns were sung. And in many traditions and many churches, hymns are still sung this way. We picked up the habit of having them written out and having the music and the score and everything. And that's how we do it now. And a lot of churches do. That's how hymn books work. We could also take our hymn book and interchange things. And if you look in our, using the word our to mean LDS, and if you're not LDS, pretend it's your hymn book for the moment. Using this hymn book, which is our, quote, new hymn book published in the mid-80s, using this, we have, the meters are here and can be interchanged, and there's a whole section in the back about how to do that. So we really, in this hymn book, really attempted to sort of join the great hymn traditions, and we also included something that hadn't happened in the earlier hymn book, and that is we have a section called tune names. And each of the tunes that are in the hymn book, or most of them anyway, the tune that it's done to has a particular name. And it can be a name associated with the place the person was when they wrote it. A friend of mine has a hymn in here, and he named it after his mother-in-law, which kept great peace in the family. And plus, she was a wonderful woman. But you have hymn tunes named Gabriel, Gentle Jesus, Gentle Way, Gladys, Glasgow. So basically, you know, that's just some from the G's. So the hymn tunes have their own identity. And there's an interchangeability that we tend not to do, but it's really fun when you get past that mental barrier and do it. That's just a little teeny bit of background. Anyway, what I was curious about was having my own experience of working on the church hymn text committee for several years when I was young, like I was in my early 20s when I did this, and most everyone else on the committee was not. In fact, I was by a great leap of probably at least a decade the youngest person on this committee, and dedicated in time and everything. From my experience of that, I've been very curious about what we've lost from here. Now, when I say lost, it's lost only in the sense of we don't do it anymore. It's in some cases probably lost in that we don't know what tunes went with these. But nonetheless, these are things that are no part of LDS worship. And as a result, we can have some very interesting experiences to look back and see what is it that we no longer do, and maybe even to guess some of the reasons why we no longer have included these, because I wasn't on the committee that did this, and I wasn't on the committee that did this. Are you familiar with these? And this also comes in red if you're the accompanist, and this is in orange if you're the accompanist. But I'm referring here to the dark blue one, which my guess is that most LDS church buildings have great piles of these in a closet. So these aren't as lost as you'd think. Never been in a building that if you didn't look far enough, you couldn't find a pile of these, a good pile. Because no one wanted to throw them away. And so what do you do with an old hymn book? You put it in a closet. And so anyway, knowing what the process we went through in dealing with the texts that went into the 80s version of the hymn book, which really would have been the 70s version, if, as Richard explained, some people hadn't thought it. Knowing what went into decisions on texts in this, I'm curious about what went into decisions on texts between this and succeeding versions. And I don't have any definitive answers. I can only tell you about that which happened in our committee, which I remember, because remember this, I was on the committee in the early 70s, and this is now 2001, which tells you like how old I am, if you calculate. And but I can address changes that occurred between here and here, at least those that I remember and those that I may have made a notation about. First of all, let me tell you a few general principles that we followed in changing from the blue hymn book with the tabernacle organ on the cover to the green hymn book with the tabernacle organ on the cover. And probably the major change that we made, main principle we used, was: is this an offensive song? And looking at it in terms of the words, we were looking at the music only in that, was it a good fit or was it outdated music? Should we recommend that someone do a little work on the hymn setting? But we wanted to be sure that the things we're in here were not making really offensive comments that were maybe okay back. The people didn't notice back when this hymn book was put together, but now when we were doing this in the 70s, would just be offensive and painful. That was very important to us. And there were some references like to, pardon me for quoting things like this, but Savage Redman and things like this that are gone, you know, and good riddance to them. They belong in a historical setting, but they don't belong in a hymn book from which we sing on Sundays or any other day of the week. And so that was really one of the arch principles we had, was we wanted to have a hymn book that everyone could come to and feel comfortable singing from and not worry about stumbling across something that, you know, was going to make them feel inferior or going to be offensive to them. And when I say offensive in the sense that we shouldn't be insulting people with the text of the hymn if it's something that they're expected to sing. Now, we did not go through and create gender-inclusive language, because remember, this most of the hymn text work was done in the early 70s. And gender-inclusive language wasn't as big a deal in the early 70s. And we would probably edit it somewhat differently now. But you have to walk a fine line. You don't want to make it so PC that you no longer have the lyricist's intent left in the music. So there's a fine line to walk there. And to help walk this line, we had some very interesting people. We had Mabel Jones Gabbett, who was the chairwoman of the committee, and truly one of the kindest, most beautiful souls ever on this earth. And we had three BYU professors, all of them were men, and three women who were not BYU professors. One went on to become an attorney, one was me, and the other was a woman who just had a wonderful tradition in her life, music and hymnody, and she was also from Europe, and so she brought a little different perspective to it than we would be bringing, not having raised in her traditions. And the BYU professors that we had were John Sterling Harris, one of the few people I know to write a poem about a pig, and he's a wonderful fellow with a great sense of humor. We had Arthur Henry King, who brought a lot of knowledge of Anglican traditions, and we had Sam Monson, who kept a balance, a very balanced person in how we approached what we were doing. So we had different points of view. We had, like, having John Sterling Harris on there, he brought a very contemporary sense to the text we were looking at. Arthur Henry King had a little different perspective, and he thought that it would be perfectly appropriate to have hymns that were writing on airplanes and things like that. Of course, all of us were just kind of gasping, you know, because we thought he would be coming from a very staid, traditional point of view, you know, and would they possibly sing about an airplane, you know, in an Anglican church? And the answer is nowadays they do. And it's us that haven't left that mold. They've left it. But anyway, that was the committee that we had, and we got into some very rousing discussions. Everyone was respectful of each other, but we very openly debated things. And one time, a member of the church priesthood committee, Melchizedek priesthood committee, to visit with us, and he sat there through our entire session, horrified and aghast. And he told me later, he says, "I was appalled at how you all yelled at each other." And I said, "Which one were you at? I don't remember we ever yelled at each other. We just debated it, and we all came to a certain extent from a sufficiently academic tradition that having a rousing debate was just part of our mindset." And I was a journalist, and I love to get people yelling at each other anyway. So we had discussion that went on every week, and we would be very invigorated by it, and other people apparently were quite horrified. And we all were great friends and had a wonderful experience, and they tolerated my youth and my inexperience. And when I moved away from Utah to move to Washington, D.C., before the committee actually ended its work, and Arthur Henry King wrote me a poem, which is one of the few poems that's ever been written to me, about me. And we had a very tearful farewell session in which everyone was bawling, and then we had a meeting and yelled at each other for 5 hours and thoroughly enjoyed it. So this was how our committee worked. And we were concerned about hymns also that had that came from a tradition that was of such a dated musical style that the music itself was dated. Now, the best example I have of this, and I hope this is not anyone's favorite hymn, was Each Cooing Dove, which was perhaps one in the hymn book we least liked. You know, with each cooing dove, and, you know, sighing bout. Now, nonetheless, when I went to Israel on a tour once, we sat on the banks of the Galilee and sang Each Cooing Dove. I didn't tell them that I'd helped excise it. Hymn book. Good riddance. To little patter choruses, you know. But there are musical styles that really are dated, and by having them... By having them as part of our worship service, they sometimes the how dated they are detracts from the worship service. And we tried not to be like too judgmental and harsh and only liking a certain style of music. We also tried not to include our own works very much, although we would have been pleased had they been included. They weren't, by and large. But we tried not to use it as a form for getting our own things into the hymn book, even though some of us had things that were on the table to be included. So we tried not to be proprietary about what we were doing. And we also had a certain amount of doctrinal purity that we would attempt to either maintain or to inject, which is probably the most controversial thing we did, and believe me, this is something we yelled a lot about in in love and affection. And we also had a concern about texts that were easily made fun of. And so we went through the hymn book listing those things that we knew caused adolescent boys to titter. And we attempted to fix these as best we could without damaging the hymn unduly. Of course, one of the things that happened was, and I will never know to my dying day if this was good or bad, but one of the things that happened was the Health Harmony Foundation ended up, we got rid of the Yoo-Hoo's Unto Jesus because, because it was so commonly made fun of. For, you know, you hear that the deacons would be on the front row, Yoo-Hoo, you know, Jesus, and making fun of it. And so Arthur Henry King is the one who's responsible for coming up with the words, for you unto Jesus, for you unto Jesus, for you unto Jesus, for we have fled. And we decided we could live with it. It wasn't a perfect solution, and we all didn't agree on it, but that's what's in print now. Is
Isn't it
fun? Oh, okay, it probably is. What page is it? 85. Okay, it's who unto the Savior for refuge have fled. You're right. One of the things we went through was for you unto Jesus. That was one of the earlier versions that didn't make it into the editing. But that was one of I'm always getting those confused. Thank you for correcting that. Who unto the Savior, we also went to for you unto Jesus, for refuge of blood. And so the repetition was not you-hoo unto Jesus. Anyway, it was Arthur who came up with the variations, and that was the one we ended up going with after probably several hours of discussion. Another thing we did that was really fun was we went through a huge stack of other hymn books. And we were each given like a pile of hymn books to take home from other churches, and we had a huge collection, like stacks. And we would go through, we would take these hymn books home, and we'd divvy them up, and then we would find the ones that were really favorites of ours, and we really thought had some good potential. And a lot of the best ones, the most fun we had, of course, was from the Anglican hymn books. And so we would basically come back, and then we'd play the hymn, and we'd all sing the hymn the next week, and see how we felt about recommending it for inclusion, seeing how the text was. Was the text doctrinally either fixable or fine as it was? And usually it was fine as it was. And so some of the new editions we have in this hymn book, at least the recommended editions, including a few that actually made it, were from this process of going through these piles of... And I say piles, not that they were in a heap, but they were stacked. Stacks and stacks of hymn books. And one of my favorite hymns from all time is now page 82 in here, For All the Saints. And I probably would have sat in the committee room refusing to ever leave and going on a hunger strike had we not included that hymn. And that was one that, of course, would have come up anyway as by going through all these other hymnals. So that's kind of a little bit of the history of things got in here, and if you have, we'll go over a couple of specific hymns and talk about those issues too. But that's basically the history of what's how this, in text-wise anyway, how this book became this book. An enormous amount of work was done in resetting all of these, and in some cases, taking what was a difficult to sing arrangement and coming up with a better arrangement. The one thing I've had an exception to, and that it was a topic of great debate among those doing the music. You know, the hymns as opposed to the texts, the tunes, was whether to transpose them into more singable keys. And being a soprano, although I was a lot higher soprano when I was younger than I am now, but being a soprano, I really liked having, you know, something in there to shoot for. It's like setting a goal to hit that G sharp or something. And they've eliminated a lot of that and reset them. And I think in so doing, and this was, they knew what they were sacrificing. This was a sacrifice they made, knowing the price that was paid. In so doing, they lost some of the brilliance in it, of the tone, because there's a big difference between a G and an A flat, for example. and the things that were in A flat, a lot of them ended up in G. And these are small changes, made them easier to sing, much easier to play. And I will grant you that it's, you know, for some words and congregations, it's important if you don't have a really experienced accompanist, at least have something they can play. And so these changes were made to make it a more usable book. I was distressed by some of the changes, but that's because I can play these. There are people who weren't distressed by the changes because they finally said, good, now I can finally play this song. And so it's a two-edged sword, and there was no good compromise, really. Another thing that they did was come out with simplified arrangements of many of the hymns so that even a less experienced accompanist can accompany the hymns, even though they're difficult, fairly difficult to play in here. So they did some wonderful things in Genesis. They did some things that maybe they wish they'd done differently. I wish they'd done differently, but we can't go back and reprint it. And I probably wouldn't change it. People are getting used to how it is now, and Sunday we'll actually know these numbers. You know, I mean, we know what 13 was in here, don't we? Don't you? Yeah, it was Come Come Ye Saints. And I don't know what it is in here. And so we have a couple of people who are getting familiar with the numbers, but, you know, we don't know the hymns by the numbers the way that we used to. And I still remember these numbers from the old hymn book. I don't know many of the numbers from the new hymn book. So it'll take us a long time, probably. And having had this change, we may never bother to memorize the numbers because we'll know they may change again. So that was the psychologist for me. Yeah?
Were any pieces commissioned for the new ones? Like some of the new pieces, did somebody in church headquarters asking people, you know,
yeah. Basically, what would happen was we got a lot of submissions. People would write an entire hymn or write the text for it. And then we would, if we decided that it was a good text and it was worth setting, then they would commission someone to write the music for it. And sometimes they would commission more than one person and then pick the version they liked the best. Yeah.
Were they given guidelines for the nature of the text for the new song?
Not really.
Because if you put the 1835 book against the 1985 book, the theological tone is quite different.
Right.
A lot of things are very different.
Yeah. No, they weren't given specific guidelines on that. Things that sounded very, if a text had sounded pretty dated, it probably wouldn't have made it through. And too many whiles and things like that, you know, that'll get you killed. But there wasn't a conscious effort to use only contemporary language either.
But no, I'm not referring to language, I'm referring to concepts. So actually,
yeah,
the text reflects cultural change,
right,
rather than text influencing cultural change.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm sure then it becomes a cycle and works both ways. Yeah. But we weren't suggesting that they, you know, write something that would be Catholic, you know. Or, you know, they knew if they were writing a text for this, they knew what would be accepted basically in terms of doctrine, and we didn't get too much that was doctrinally strange. Mostly what we got were really strained rhymes and things like that. And when you get those, you know, if it's hard to read, it's going to be murdered to sing. And things that didn't fall easily off the tongue and really weren't referable. I mean, you can do a lot to fix a poem if there's or a text if there's really a good kernel in there, and we oftentimes would send it back saying we really like this and this, can we, you know, try this a little differently, and, you know, and if we saw one more rhyme where we rhymed love and above, you know, but that's sort of, I mean, it's just one of those words, not many things rhymes with it. Those were the kinds of constraints that we imposed ourselves on. We basically set our own rules and decided what we would do. And not all of our recommendations were taken by any means. And some things were changed because of copyright issues. And, you know, I mean, a lot of what we recommended just ended up as an academic point that never was followed later down the road. But nonetheless, there are things in here that are here because of certain reasons. Yes? Church. There was the church music committee, basically. Oh yeah, we were peons. In terms of, you know, I mean, we couldn't make final decisions, but we made very strong recommendations, and they were pretty good about taking out a lot of the things we didn't think still belonged in the hymn book. I'm going to talk about the one that I know Lee has a question about. Would you like to ask your question, Lee, and then I'll answer it. Come now. Yeah, what happened to it? Yeah. Okay, the question is, what happened to Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, which is one of the truly great American hymns? And actually, I'm going to have to look up the number in here. Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, page 70, I should have memorized that. Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, second verse. Oh, to grace, how great a debtor daily I'm constrained to be. And in the 70s, the word grace was absolutely verboten in the church, in publications, and I say this as someone who was an editor for the church. You didn't discuss grace, because there were, at that time anyway, there were some real reservations about the way the concept of grace was interpreted in the Christian tradition. And the interpretation supposedly was that salvation was something that was just handed to you. And we had a much more, a much stronger approach than I see now of you got to work for it yourself. And so the idea of grace was aligning us with the Protestant tradition that that the church wasn't willing to ascribe strongly to. Now, whether the brethren themselves would have actually taken it out because of the word grace or not, I don't know. But that was the concern that was raised about the hymn. Nonetheless, many of us loved the hymn.
Why not just drop that verse? Yeah. I've seen that before.
Because there's only two in this version.
Oh, okay, because yeah. Reality is yeah. There are a lot more.
Yeah. And so it's also real integral in the hymn. And so that was the discussion that I recall having about it, and it's not in this hymn book. And my presumption is that that's probably the main reason it's not in the new hymn book, is because of the doctrinal concern about the word grace, which now, interestingly enough, we don't seem to worry about. That you listen to all the sessions of General Conference, and there's an acknowledgement of grace. Not a denial that we need to do something to work out our own salvation, with fear and trembling, but there's an acknowledgement of the concept of grace as we're getting, in the sense that we're getting more than we're giving. That God gives us more than we can possibly ever really deserve or earn or whatever. And so we accept the term grace in that sense now. Yeah.
So did your committee recommend against
you? No, I can't remember. I suspect we raised a concern about the word, and that probably was echoed by others, because it was a term that in the church, I know in church editing at the time, we did not allow the concept of grace to make it through to the principal page. Yeah.
So that would be the explanation
for why. Exactly. Also, it was such a strongly Protestant hymn that there was also some reservation about some hymns that were too Protestant. Nonetheless, we have How Great Thou Art in here, which if ever there was a Protestant hymn, that's How Great Thou Art. So, what time does this end?
You have about
10 minutes. Okay. So I want to play a little portion of you heard it just as we were starting to. Would someone mind catching the door back there? I don't want to hurt too many people or even let them know we're having fun. I want to play just a little portion of this. This is a 5-minute setting, and so I don't want to take 5 minutes for it, but I want you to see what wonderful things can happen when times change, because times have changed since the original recommendations were made that created this hymn book. Remember, the recommendations were made in the 70s, the hymn book was printed in the 80s. And, well, some recommendations were also made in the 80s, but a lot of the work that was done was done in the 70s. This is Mac Wilbert's arrangement of Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, which is sung joyously at state conferences. It's a hard song to sing. It's a difficult arrangement, and it's just exultant. It's wonderful. And it's BYU. It's on tapes from CDs from BYU and a video from BYU. And it's a magnificent recording. This is a magnificent recording. This is Mac Wilbert actually doing it himself. But it's also really magnificent to see that this song that kind of went out of favor between here and here is now turning into one of our favorite choral pieces that choirs stretch to be able to hit those high notes and sing the parts. So this is full circle. This is full circle. Not only has it come back, it's come back in glory. So he's taken this very simple melodic line and it just expands. I'm going to keep talking over it if you don't mind. Okay? There's a point where I probably won't be able to because it's kind of loud. But one of the things I was curious about was, do any of the songs that were in here in this little book exist in other places now so we can even know what they were like?
Yeah.
For you now, I've sweetened you up with that. Play one that's not quite so sweet. And this is probably more like what it sounded like when it was done. It's the hymn tune is Victoria. And this is one that was in the early edition and 28, let me go to track. Let me get off the dialogue box. and wrote a tract 28. This is from the original Sacred Heart. Part of the Sacred Heart tradition is sort of find a pitch. There we go. They'll find a pitch. It'll be pitched. They'll sing it through words, singing the shape names, which I won't bother to explain. Sung with quite that level of enthusiasm, not too often. Yeah. Or the children singing Book of Mormon stories would have that level of enthusiasm if they got their hands into it. And one of the things that in losing the style, in changing the style and going to a style where the melody line is on top and it's very structured and formal and sounds like something to be sung in Queen Victoria's court, what we lose by this is sort of the part of the sort of primitive sense of power that the music itself carries. And this is something that can be regained merely by shifting the arrangement and going back to the original arrangement, or a more original arrangement. I mean, these hymns have gone through the folk process. They have changed so many times. This captured them at one point in time, basically. And what I've done in various wards I've lived in is put together small ensembles and kind of not really the shapes, and sung these for special musical numbers. Yeah.
Did you guys have discussions about, like, totally non-European?
Or Asian musical tradition, we didn't really explore those.
Oh, my God.
A little bit. That was a little bit before the cultural ascendancy of gospel. Yeah. The Indian culture.
What was
the about the different people like different things and didn't like different things, and that they would make those kinds of decisions and independent of our recommendations. And that we were, like I said, we were way down the rung, way down the rungs in the ladder in terms of we didn't have the power to do it. So there was a real political sense of different people among church leadership felt very strongly. About certain things needing to be in certain ways. And some people felt very strongly we shouldn't have any hymn books. And some people felt strongly we should have any hymn books. And so eventually we had any hymn books.
What was the
hold up? The decade long hold up. I don't know what the preference was. Yeah. I mean, it's.
and maybe not even die, but just mellow and change their minds and go ahead and let it happen, even if they thought it wasn't. You know, and by the time it happened, by the time the new hymn book was published, I think there was a lot of unanimity that it was a good thing to have some fresh new hymns and some of the really good hymns of, for example, the European tradition coming back in. So, and also to have some that were more uniquely LDS than had been before. Yeah.
Who has the names of the women? Who tells us the names of the other people? I didn't get the names of the women.
The reason I didn't mention the other women is I can't remember the name because I was 23.
Where was Karen Lynn Davidson? Was she on the Texas Music Committee?
I don't know. She wasn't on the Texas Committee. Not on the Texas Committee, no.
Oh, but she must have been on that next one.
There were uncountable committees. So we were in charge of one of the Texas.
Oh,
not uncountable, but a lot of committees. Different generations of committees. And I'm really embarrassed. I can't remember the name because she lived in my ward, and I can picture her. I can tell you about her doing where she went on vacation, and her name is. So that's why we're doing it.
Do you know the story of the change in music and Ethan Hyde Co-op?
No, except that now that it's bundled and much nicer.
But you know the other words to that.
Beneath
the Gallows Tree?
Yeah.
Yeah. Gives some people a little different tone.
Yeah. Well, and the Von Williams setting is from totally different things he's done.
Sure.
You know, I've got a CD of Von Williams and this, and that, and if you could have a Cola tune, comes out on that CD in totally different orchestral settings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been applied to other hymns, you know, but it's a wonderful tune. I love the tune. And I'm really delighted they made that change because the tune is just. I mean, I actually wrote a set of words myself to the tune called Morning Star. Yeah.
Well, I've always wondered, you mentioned how great they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did a couple of, like, the words were changed. And then for the last bit, and then kind of the original words. And everyone I've talked to, you can't see what the song is.
So, what
is the song?
No, it wasn't my fault. We were using a version that had, and the version, the copyright, and so to quote it from copyright and to show that we were changing what was in copyrighted version, we had to indicate what those changes were.
But isn't How Great Thou Art is also a Swedish song to start with?
I don't know if you believe
it. I think the original
was Storybook.
Oh, Storybook. Yes, and I just wondered whose translation into English is closer.
I know, I
just. No, I think
okay, I need to tell you why Glenn isn't very thinking one. Glenn has written two new hymns. We dare call them hymns. Glenn really wanted to be here, but his work assignment has taken him to England, and he was in town the wrong week to come to this, and he offered to take the farm on and actually fly back to do this, and I said, it's okay. You don't need to do that. Glenn's new hymns, which unfortunately I don't have with me, he was going to send them, and somehow they've gotten lost in the transmission. He's written two new sort of hymns celebrating other places that the church was other than Utah. And so in his hymn about Ohio, each verse ends with, and the land was flat. They're very funny, very delightful, and I wish I had them to share with you, but I don't think he did. When we were in England recently, he did come to our hotel room and he played them for us on his computer, where he's done them through MIDI before. And they were very funny. We got a good laugh out of him, and I'm sorry you can't get the same good laugh out of me, but that's a great one, and I'm laugh. And so he was basically making fun of the fact that, we got to need to explain this, that we celebrated the mountain pie, but to the early saints, the land was flat. On that note, thank you for your participation. And those of you who are interested in the Shape Notes session that we'll be having this afternoon, I hope that you come ready to sing because I'm losing my voice. And we'll have some fun. And we'll also, one of the real treats is we will do what may well have been the original music that we used for how the Spirit of God was part of Bernie, as well as what something has changed. So the Spirit of God was part of Bernie, just to keep your interest within one of these.